Today, I talk with Dr. Steven Alter, Professor Emeritus at University of San Francisco. Professor Alter is the author of 7 published books and many journal articles. His work is published in some of the top journals in the information systems field. Over the course of many years of research, he developed a system analysis method for business professionals called the Work System Method. His published work describes work system theory and useful extensions related to work system principles, work system design spaces, workarounds, system interactions, and tools for establishing more effective communication between business and IT professionals. Through his work, Professor Alter is recognized for creating an integrated conceptual basis for understanding and analyzing IT-reliant systems from a business viewpoint. Today, with Professor Alter, we discuss research motivated by philosophical pragmatism. We discuss the need for clear concepts, the quest to be pragmatic, the problem of method in information system field, and the issue of whether the wider world will care if the IS academic field stops existing. With this, I bring you Professor Alter. Hello, Professor Alter. Welcome to the Sigfil podcast. And I'm looking forward to our discussion. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to this talk because I believe that you have this unique experience being in the industry for a longer period of time and then switching to the academia. And I find that rather unique in the field. So I would like to, let's say, just give brief historical overview, how you make the decision, and is this, let's say, impacting somehow your research or, let's say, I would say, underlying assumptions in your research?
Okay. Well, I actually, I got my PhD at MIT and I taught at USC for a while, and for family reasons, I needed to move to the Bay Area. And a friend of mine from grad school was starting a small company that was basically a consulting company. And eventually it became a software company. And I was with that for 8 years. And then actually at one point, Silicon Valley was in terrible shape, and we had a great company and a great product and great customers, but we didn't have any sales. So basically our venture capital people said, well, you know, you guys have to do a big layoff. And eventually I had to leave. So yeah. I was living in San Francisco and I got a job at the University of San Francisco. Yeah. And one day a book representative from Addison Wesley, which is a big publishing company, came in and said, how do you like the information system textbooks that you're using? And I said, yeah, I mean, they're pretty good. I mean, they make sense and so on. But let me tell you, they actually would not have helped my staff and they would not have helped my customers. And so one thing led to another. And eventually I wrote a series of information system textbooks. And those textbooks were designed to try to produce something that would have helped my staff and would have helped my customers. And the work system ideas that I worked on for such a long time actually came out of that entire effort. So the decision of moving from industry to academia was actually just expediency. You know, I live close to the university. I could walk my daughter to kindergarten. I thought, this is nice. Yeah. And then eventually I had to figure out what to do. And I ended up writing textbooks and then doing some research.
And what your work system method and then later on theory is actually, I would like maybe, I think don't exaggerate, but a lot of people when they are looking for an ingenious theory about information systems, they point to your work as one of them. And I don't remember I have read or heard somewhere how they actually did you came up with this idea. And then if you can explain this a little bit, and then we can, let's say, due to the nature of our podcast, to discuss a little bit, were there some philosophical
okay.
implications?
So actually, recently, Nick Hassan and others have put together a paper, a call for papers about using Foucault's ideas about discursive formation to discuss something about information systems. And I produced a paper for that. And when I went through the various steps in discursive formation, the first couple of steps were about what's the paradigm and what's the question and stuff like that. And that reminded me of something that was actually in the preface of the second edition of my textbook. So I went back and looked. And so I wrote a first edition of the textbook with the general idea that I was going to try to help business people. And then gradually it occurred to me that just talking in the abstract about systems just wasn't clear enough. It wouldn't have helped people enough. So every chapter started with an example that was an example of an information system. And I wanted to go further with that. And then they invited me to do a book tour. So a book tour, I went to 22 different universities and a few research institutions and basically gave a 45-minute presentation that said, imagine that you were a bunch of business people and I'm going to give you a presentation that's going to tell you something about information systems. And it's going to be valuable to you in some meeting you're going to go to tomorrow. But unfortunately, I actually don't know what industry you're in, and I don't know what the meeting is about. And still, I want to tell you something that's going to give you a viewpoint that's useful for that meeting, probably. So I gave that presentation multiple times. And from that presentation, I developed a questionnaire that I gave to executive MBA students. And I said to them, go into your companies and find a work system that uses IT that has some kind of problem or opportunity, and use this questionnaire to, and it wasn't a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kind of questionnaire. It was, here's a question, were there any workarounds? What was the big problem? Was the information okay? And so on and so forth, those kinds of questions, and they had to answer them with paragraphs. And gradually that, became those ideas informed what were the next few versions of the textbook, and eventually that became the work system method. So it came from trying to get business professionals to look at work systems in their own organizations in an organized way, and that's what the work system method was.
And what is interesting is that I see now that you actually took the other way around. You said, okay, I want to see what the practice needs, and I'm going to, based on that, expand and provide a solution that will actually help them to practically solve. I'm not going to try so much to explore what paradigm or what, let's say, view of the world is happening. But did you have any experience of that, or you just said, I'm going to practically solve this problem?
I was in a software company for 8 years. Yeah. We weren't really worried about paradigms and stuff like that. We were worried about producing software that was going to help our customers solve their problems. Yeah. Now, that involved a great deal of abstraction on our part of talking to customers and trying to figure out how could we abstract from all these different ideas and problems that they had into something that we could put into software. In that particular instance, the abstraction was that in semiconductors, you have a very complicated process. Each process has a certain number of steps. The steps contain involve engineering information. You're concerned about planning and scheduling and so on. So we ended up with abstractions related to running a factory and producing products. And that's what we were concerned with. So we weren't concerned with broader intellectual questions about what is your paradigm and stuff like that. Actually, the same thing really applied during my PhD training at MIT. I think the people who I knew at MIT Sloan actually were not interested in philosophy. They were interested in trying to solve problems in the world primarily.
Yeah, and what I hear is like, solving the problem, and then I will come back maybe this and I will say, okay, what about the US pragmatics, you know, the pragmatic approach? Not the goal is not to, let's say, the goal is to find what works in a way. And based on that, I always, when I read your work in the years, as I mentioned previously, I have used your work to, let's say, guide my students in their research. And what I see is that you always try to keep down to earth writing and down to earth suggestions, and very clear in a way. So my question is, you started 30 years ago and you still keep that approach in a way. So I believe that you have recognized as a very valuable approach, like a very valuable position, that you actually need to be more practice oriented and more, let's say, not industry supportive, but community supportive with your writings and your reasoning and your suggestions. While some other scholars, where I read, after I read the papers, I still don't know what they mean, you know?
Yeah, well, you're getting at a problem that's a very big problem in the academic information system field.
Yeah.
You know, we've had all these discussions about rigor versus relevance.
Yeah.
And actually, we have a very big problem with rigor in this field.
Yeah.
And rigor is not about doing fancy statistics on a body of data. Rigor is about defining terms. Fundamentally, it's about defining what you're talking about and being really clear about it. And so writing textbooks, I had a very good developmental editor when I first wrote my first edition, and yeah, she beat me over the head every time I said things that were too abstract, because yeah, she said, you know, people have to understand what you're talking about. And she was absolutely right. And of course, that was for a textbook. So it was for a general purpose textbook for undergraduates and MBA. So it couldn't be tremendously abstract. But right now in the academic information system field, I think that we are far too comfortable using terms without defining them. And here are some specific examples. I wrote an entire paper one time in ISJ about how we should retire the concept of IT artifact. And the reason for that was that I could cite five or six different leading scholars who use that term in completely different ways. So yep, if I say I'm going to tell you about IT artifacts, you actually fundamentally don't know what I'm talking about. And the same problem has continued to today when people have discussions about artificial intelligence. Yep. And then someone said, I'll tell you about artificial intelligence. And I would ask, well, are you talking about robots, or are you talking about machine learning, which are two completely different topics?
Yeah.
And their only similarity is that they happen to come vaguely from some stream of concerns about knowledge and that kind of thing. So let me just finish one more. That's a long answer, but let me finish one more thing.
Yeah.
In producing software, we had to create abstractions. Abstraction is tremendously important.
Yeah.
We had to create abstractions that were meaningful, but those abstractions couldn't be things like socio-materiality. They had to be things like process and product and engineering item and so on and so forth, things that everybody in that world understood. And so that's what I've tried to do in my writing, is generally try to be as clear as possible and to define terms as clearly as possible so that people know what I'm talking about.
And sometimes when I discuss with other scholars and privately in a way, and then you will need to, let's say, to justify your writing and let's say theoretical contribution, that means that you need to invent concepts. And sometimes in order to make an impact, the dialogue is that you need to be, let's say, a little bit vague in order to open the space so the others could try to, let's say, think what you think, and then write their opinion what they think about what you think. And this becomes a little bit problematic in this whole process. And what I hear is from you, we should try to be more concise, in more clear when we conceptually, let's say, introduce concepts and define them clearly what we mean by them. How you do that? Because I have to be honest, when I read your work, I read it once and I know what you want to say, and it's clear to me to what you refer. And this may be related to your coming first in business, and especially software where you need to abstract, but to real things, and then coming to academia. Can you share a little bit on this?
I'll come at it in two different ways.
Yeah.
So one is that our standard practice in an awful lot of academic writing is to talk about, is to speak in abstractions without any real examples.
Yeah.
And that drives me crazy. When I read papers and people are just talking about abstractions and I don't know exactly what they're talking about because it's very abstract, then that I just, you know, get very frustrated with that. So what I think should be a standard practice in our field is that, which no one's going to do, but I think we should identify the 5 or 6 most important abstractions in almost any paper, starting with what they mean by information system, and give 5 examples that are real examples of it. So then those examples show what the abstractions mean, because you're absolutely right about the fact that you've got to say abstractions are inherently vague and open to interpretation. And that's very important. That's how things move forward when you look at interpretations and you say, well, maybe I could think about it a slightly different way and so on. But it's hard to get back to what you're talking about. Now, let me just mention one thing about my own stuff. I recently published a paper in CIAS called Facets of Work, which basically says when you think about a system, it's often useful to break up the work that's being done into the aspects that are about decision-making versus communication versus coordinating versus physical work versus improvising and so on and so forth.
Yep.
And I wrote a paper, I sent it into CAIS, and I got a review back. It was a great review. Every once in a while, a review comes back that's really a great review. And the review came back and he said, you know, there's some interesting ideas here, but actually, you sort of assumed I knew what you were talking about. And I think other readers wouldn't know what you were talking about initially and would be lost.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be a very, very valuable piece of feedback. So then I fixed the paper and I think it now means something. But so I'm glad that you understand a lot of the things that I say, but actually if I start by just talking about work systems and I say, here's the work system framework and that's what it is and so on and so forth, a lot of times people don't understand that even after I even after I define it, they don't understand it. And here's a specific example. I sent a paper into a very leading journal.
Yeah.
And one of the reviews came back and said, basically, I look at this work system framework and I don't understand those variables. Well, the fact was that those weren't variables. Those were components of a system. They weren't variables at all. And so the person had no idea what I was talking about, even after I gave the same discussion that I've given many times. So it is definitely a very big problem. And I don't have a general answer to it other than trying hard to define terms, trying hard to provide examples.
You know, I was, when I was reading, when I did my master thesis, I did some consultancy also. And then my master thesis was about how the SMEs are getting digitalized in the textile sector in the region where I was living, very textile, let's say, dependent region. Mm-hmm. And then I based my research based on the articles, etc. And then I went in the companies and I found out that 95% of the things which I was asking them, they were not aware about that as problems or as issues, etc. So I needed to find a completely different way to actually identify how they can be digitalized. And based on that, later on when I was reading, I started finding that these clear concepts, and even not introduction of concepts, is I like the work of Bunge, where he actually makes this very clear. So when you read him, you understand what he says. And my question is, like, also Bunge and other scholars that I read, etc., we need to theorize, we need to abstract. And here I can actually say your work, where you say it's not every abstraction is okay. It's not only theory that we need to move and to create. So I just now want to connect it with this, let's say, abstraction, which philosophy is making to the highest level of abstraction, etc. And in your paper, you talk that there is value in different abstractions. So based on this, what will you say? Because you created and you mentioned sometimes you create the method, the framework, and then when you were submitting your work in journals, they were asking you to come up with the theory. And my question is, like, now, how to start? Should we move to theory? Because you were working on work system theory for method framework for 30 years, and it's such a devotion. So can you, let's say, share how to build this ecosystem of research? Because you mentioned it when I started writing the book, I was seeing and asking MBA students about, did you use workarounds, etc.? And then you see that now you have a theory of workaround paper, and that is 20 years, you know? So my idea is, a lot of pressure now in the IS communities to publish fast and quick and just to get tenure and share your opinion. And you have this consistency of research and writing. And my question is, how can be done by the others? How can be replicated, if that is the right word?
Okay, well, that's a very difficult question. So there were certain unique situations that happened in my life that will not happen in other people's lives. So I happened to be in industry for a long time. I happened to write textbooks based on that. That got me started on what I was working on. And then while I was writing the textbooks, I was at the University of San Francisco, which at the time was definitely not a research school. And it still really isn't a research school. It's more of a teaching school, but they expect research. But if I had been at a research school, like if I'd been down the road at Stanford, I would have never been able to produce the stuff that I produced.
Yeah.
And the reason is because I would have had to jump through more academic hoops more quickly. And it just takes too long to let stuff germinate over many years. So I worked on that stuff for many years. And then I just got interested in it. So I kept on working on it. Right now, if you told me I have to produce a paper to be published within a year, and it has to be on the stuff that you're talking about, you generally talk about, I wouldn't necessarily be sure exactly how to do it. Even after I've developed a lot of ideas and try to continue extending them, I would say my hit rate on conference papers and journal papers is maybe 40%, 40%. And the reason is because the papers don't exactly fit into the way other people are thinking, et cetera, et cetera. We do have a very big problem with this in the academic information system field. One way of talking about that problem is that we actually are not interested in accumulating knowledge in the field, contrary to what we say. If we were interested in accumulating knowledge in the field, then some group of people would take work system ideas and would actually really work on them to figure out how can we talk about the knowledge there. I've done that kind of like as an individual, but that doesn't have critical mass. Someone else might take conceptual modeling and really work on conceptual modeling and say, what are the limits and what what are the benefits and what are the limits of doing this? Someone else might take some completely different view, might take soft system methodology or activity theory. and really try to work on it, not just say, I'm going to write yet another paper, I'm going to apply activity theory to block. Instead, say, I'm going to take those ideas, I'm going to really work on what are their benefits and what are their limits in understanding situations? What examples do they work in? What examples do they not work in? And that's something we just don't tend to do in this field.
And do you think that this might be due to the nature of the field, because we are all the time bombarded with new developments, new technological developments, new, let's say, organizational developments? And somehow, for example, when you read, it should be new, it should be interesting. And for example, if I take the work systems method, then somebody might say, well, this is already 20 years old and you should find or create your own method, or let's say suggest something novel that could actually be fitting to this situation. So my question is, do we suffer from that we are omnipresent and fast developing field?
We suffer in several very important ways. Yeah. One of the ways that we suffer is that a lot of the stuff that was produced 20 years ago, a lot of the research that was produced 20 years ago that was good research at the time, actually is obsolete. And we really don't want to say that. And so we do lots of literature reviews and so on, but very few literature reviews will come out and say, this is what people said at that time. But obviously, you know, that's at that time and the technology has changed totally. And what someone might have said about whether managers can use computers 20 years ago,
yeah,
is completely different now. So a finding that you'd have then would be wrong now. One that I recently cited was something about paying attention to gender and paying attention to nationality when trying to implement IT. And yeah, I mean, today that wouldn't be politically correct. So anyway, there's that kind of issue.
Yeah.
Separately, there's the issue of what really lasts and what doesn't last. And so what I think is that ideas like, let's take the idea of activity theory. I think that idea was useful at various times and remains useful today by people who really understand it and use it. We see publications coming out about that every once in a while. And I think the same thing applies to work system theory as it's now developed, because now it actually is clear enough and can be used again. Those are both at a level of abstraction that does not depend on specific technologies and does not depend on specific social contexts and so on. Let me just mention one more thing.
Yeah.
When you take the work system approach and say, well, it's from 20 years ago, how is it related to artificial intelligence? Yeah. Well, I just wrote a paper that explains how it's related to artificial intelligence. And the answer is, it's not about artificial intelligence. What artificial intelligence generates a kind of algorithm. If we took machine learning, it generates a kind of algorithm. For that kind of algorithm to be useful, it has to become part of a work system. And so the place where it's really useful is to think of the work system, think of the place of the roles that the algorithmic agent or digital agent or whatever you want to call it plays in that work system. And then think about whether that role is good. Think about whether it introduces bias in the work system and so on. And so these very old ideas actually still apply. But they don't, but those ideas don't help you with engineering a neural network. That requires completely different set of ideas.
And let me, when you mentioned the work systems and the agency the other theories, what I wonder is this what we are thinking, is when you created a higher abstraction in a way, a more integrated holistic abstraction, I would say, then you can actually see how this fits to the developments that are happening. Because if you go too narrow to some certain point and you measure 2-3 variables or something like that, then it might become problematic, because when the technology changes, the nature of those variables change, and as a result, the knowledge becomes rather faster obsolete. That is one thing. And the other one, which I'm thinking is, should we, I think there was one article where it says the problem with IS is that we are more autopsy doing. So my based on that was like, can we be more future oriented, more let's say thought experiment oriented, what could be? So we write it now and then we see after 5-6 years did what we wrote now really becomes present in the reality within 5-6 years. So, and should this be made clear? So my idea, my question is like, should we go more integral, like more pluralistic embedding in the frameworks which we create, abstractions which we create, and should those abstractions be more future oriented than, let's say, based on the past, because the past becomes radically obsolete?
Well, there are a lot of questions there.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that we bump into immediately, if we talk about anything related to the future, is that our the methodologies that are in this field are not related to the future.
Yeah.
They're related to how systems work now, or they're related to analyzing statistical data that was gathered related to about how systems work in the past. And so there are some techniques like simulation techniques that get at some ideas in the future, agent-based simulations, but they don't really go very far into the future. Some systems dynamics modeling that I learned about when I was a grad student does something about the future. But I mean, I think almost any paper that's really about the future would be rejected by most of our journals because it doesn't fit into standard methodologies that we currently have. Now, if we want to look into the future, one of the things I think we really need to do is solidify what we know right now. Mm-hmm. I just continuing that thought. In the Ziegfeld session that was during ISIS, I gave a presentation and Rudy Hirschheim asked a really interesting question about, you said this stuff and it seems interesting and so on. And okay, but actually, does it really resonate with people? And my answer was, I've tried to get people to pay attention to it. Some people do, some people don't. But fundamentally, at one point, I just decided that I was going to try to solve that problem independent of whether the way I solved it was something that other people wanted. Because I was personally convinced that it was a valuable thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm in a position now, I'm a emeritus professor. I'm in a position to do that kind of thing without worrying about whether I can publish it in a good journal tomorrow. But most of us really aren't in that kind of position. So our institution really gets, our institutions in the academic IS field get in the way of doing real future-oriented research.
And my question now, I will go back with this one. Do you think that, like, I would say, like, your pragmatic, let's say, conceptually clear goal approach, could this be, in a way, beneficial in, let's say, making clear about what we are researching and how this could impact the future? I'm trying because sometimes I don't want to put a round or a labels about your philosophical assumptions or something like that, but I have the feeling that you're a pragmatically oriented person and that you try in the academic work, in your academic work, to make clear what you say and think about how the others that will read your work will understand that, so they can really, that what you write can really help them solve the different problems that they have. And so I apologize if I wrongly label this, but do you think that this pragmatical approach, and let's say even pluralistic approach, where you take what it's appropriate and make it clear and identify how it could be used could be helpful to the ICE field?
This is part of the rigor versus relevance. This is the relevance part.
Yes, I'm
guilty of being pretty pragmatic. I plead guilty to that. On the other hand, I try to develop abstractions that people can use in solving real problems. I lost track of a thought I had there.
My idea is that if you, as you mentioned it, create clear concepts, clarified, could this be practically valuable? And should this be the stream that we should, as IS scholars, focus on more? So we can say we will provide academic relevance by actually being practically clear in a way.
I guess for my own purposes, I've decided that the work system approach has practical relevance and can be used by business people based on the fact that I collected over 700 papers over many years that MBA and executive MBA students have produced, analyzing their own, using those ideas in various versions to analyze their own systems in their own organizations. And what I generally found from those papers was that the basic ideas were pretty clear, that people could use them to visualize what was going on, but that I thought that they needed some deeper ideas that went into some areas more deeply than just the kind of what's the work system framework, what's the work system life cycle model. And that's why I started to develop extensions of work system theory. One of the things I think is really striking about the information system field is if you ask, what's the basic knowledge in the information system field? And then went to biology and asked, what's the basic knowledge there?
Yeah.
The basic knowledge goes on in books and books and books in many different fields. And it goes into tremendous depth with extremely deep terminology. And of course, the reason why that's possible is because biology is a natural science. And so it's not, the basic phenomena aren't changing all the time. It's important for us, if we want to have impact in the world, to look at real problems and that people have, and be able to understand those problems, and then be able to abstract from those real situations something that's of use to someone else who doesn't have that exact same problem in that exact same place. So this comes back to, how do you abstract from, what's the language that you have for abstracting? What's the way that you can make knowledge claims that something that you're saying is relevant to something else? One of the most important parts of that, in my opinion, is to say very clearly, what is the domain that I'm talking about? That's something that came out of, I came to understand that about 20 years ago when I was doing some research about IS risk with someone who was an expert on IS risk. Her name was Susan Scherer. And I met her one time at a conference and we started working together. And she really was on top of the idea of IS risk at that time. And so we analyzed the generalizations that were about IS risk that were in various sources that were in her library at that time. You know, obviously now we'd have the internet, we'd be able to get many other sources in other ways. But what we found out, let's say we came up with the idea that management support is very important for the success of CAD systems for left-handed architects. Mm-hmm. And that was the finding in a particular study.
Yeah.
And of course, not everyone's a left-handed architect. So then the question is, how useful is this finding about management support is important? And so our paper ended up saying, well, that was about some particular topic, but it's actually relevant to a much broader topic. And it turns out that the same topic of management support is relevant to almost every system that you might imagine that it would be an information system. So the question is, what is the relevant domain for what we're talking about? And so in doing empirical research, regardless of which, whether it's interpretive or survey or what, one of the questions is, what is the method and what is the information that we use to come to our conclusions about our situation? And another question is, what is the real domain that we're talking about? This is one instance in a domain that's a broader domain. And I think that most of our theories are totally unclear about what is the domain that they talk about. And I think that that's a very major problem. If you looked at the IS World Wiki, the wiki about theories in IS, I think you probably, I haven't done this recently, but I think you'd probably find that the domain, the relevant domain for most of the theories isn't mentioned or is totally unclear.
Yeah. It's more or less like how to incorporate an other field theory that is actually to a certain extent contextualized there, and then just to try to replicate it here or without even, let's say, that's good, but not to try to, let's say, clearly extend it or change it or improve it to demonstrate how the dynamics in our field happens. Because our field, as you mentioned, is always like the processes, the interactions, the context, the social context in which is happening all this, the development of the technologies. And probably without clearly denotating or let's say clearly stating that the context in which this domain, in which this is valuable, limits our possibility to abstract it. And as a result, because we fail in the first instance and then our abstraction is a little bit, let's say, Frankenstein, it cannot be used by the others. And as a result, we don't probably give too much to other disciplines with our theories, with our models. And this impacts our relevance. And just a note over here, I'm very confident and I'm very likable about our field and in the information systems work, etc. But what I get sometimes disappointed is because our impact, the information systems impact in practice, it's huge. It's huge. It's everywhere. I have my colleagues now with whomever I in the economics department, with marketing department, finance department, they all recognize the importance of information systems and digitalization. But when we go in the academic world, we see that we are lagging behind this impact. And my question is, what is your opinion about this? How we can actually not only use different theories, but also generate our theories and bring back value to the other disciplines?
I guess I have a view of that is not shared by a very large number of people. I think that the idea, one of my thesis advisors, Peter Keen, in the very first ISIS meeting in 1980, introduced the idea of a reference theory and said that, well, you know, they're reference discipline, and there are these reference disciplines out there and we just use them and whatever he said. And so we've picked up that idea, and then that idea eventually became the idea of native theories, where somehow it was important to have native theories that then demonstrated how wonderful we were compared and were different from other disciplines. I think that idea is actually fundamentally wrong. It may be expedient politically, because in academia, you need to demonstrate various things for your own academic legitimacy. But in terms of the benefit to the world, the idea that there are reference disciplines and our discipline, and we put a big fence around our discipline, and we say that the things that are developed inside of our discipline are native theories and so on, that's not a way to have maximum impact in the world. That's a way to just talk to yourself. So basically, like, you could ask, is work system theory a native theory? work system theory, its basic statement doesn't mention information systems. It turns out that information systems are a special case. Information systems are work systems, most of whose activities are involve processing information, which means capturing and storing and retrieving and displaying and so on information. The value of work system theory is that it's not specifically about information systems. It's about systems in the world that are activity systems. And so my view is that our great focus on reference disciplines versus the IS discipline and on native theories and so on is actually counterproductive. The thing about reference disciplines that's really important is that we often take terms from reference disciplines and then we use them in different ways. So we're not true to what they meant in the reference discipline anyway. A good example is the many uses of the term service, where there's service operations, there's discussions of service in economics, there's discussions of service in computer science, as in client-server computing and so on. And so what does that mean in information systems? And someone just picks some random definition of service and says, that's what I mean. And then they go on and they eventually it just gets all mushed up because you're not sure exactly what they're talking about in relation to what someone else was talking about with service. Yeah. So I think that our focus should be more on producing things that actually are useful for solving problems in the world.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to keep repeating that, but that's what I'm
saying. No. It's just I'm fascinated in a way that we are you actually are pragmatic completely in a way, I would say. And it's when I hear you and actually and I assume also when the others will hear this podcast, is actually that why are we here? We are here to solve the problems, but this in knowing your work and our discussions is not only to, let's say, solve a concrete problem, but actually by solving concrete problems, we will be able to, let's say, abstract solutions that people will use it to solve their problems, similar problems in different contexts, or the same problem in different contexts, or similar problem in the same context. So it's actually, when in my perspective, when I'm talking about philosophy and etc., I try to say I'm biased in a way that, okay, we need to differentiate ourselves and we need to show that we have value to the world. But I always fail to in a way to demonstrate how to show our value. And I find your approach valuable, that we, if we be pragmatic and try to solve problems based and on those solutions, we abstract and come up with concepts or frameworks or methods or theories, then we are actually much more valuable to the community. And based on that value to the community, we'll probably get more academic relevance. And do I capture this in a way?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I want to go back to something you said 15 minutes ago, which was about being clear, but maybe not being too precise.
Yeah.
Recently I was writing something and I looked up a few papers, and one very interesting paper I found by Sebastian Bull and Dubravka Kekmanovich. I don't know how to pronounce her name exactly. It was about information. They quoted several philosophers, and both Popper and Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
Basically said, many other things were cited, but roughly speaking, both of them said, the important thing is to be understood. The important thing is not to be precise. And I think they closed with something by Wittgenstein saying, it's important to provide enough vagueness so that people can can bring your own thoughts to the to it and use the idea not just sort of have it as a prison that holds them back. And that actually made me think of something that I saw in the San Francisco Art Museum, the San Francisco Modern Art Museum. There was a beautiful painting by Gerhard Richter, who's a German painter. And it was a beautiful painting of a woman who's looking at a book. And there was something written on the wall next to it where he said, it's important not to be too precise. And I thought, you know, that picture was just a little bit fuzzy in many things. You knew exactly what it was when you looked at it. You saw it was beautiful across the room. You saw it when you get close to it, you still see it's beautiful, but it's not exactly precise, maybe like an old Dutch master painting would be, which also is wonderful in some way. Yeah. And so that's the thing. Our abstractions need to provide enough room that people can be inspired by them and can think in new ways about them, but they shouldn't be so precise that no one can do anything with them.
Yeah, only to replicate them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is in a way the, I will come back to the very beginning and how you do that, because I like your writing, and if you read, and a lot of people will not have chance to talk with you, but they will need to understand you through your readings. Is it possible to give us a hint how you do that? You know, how you write your abstractions in a clear way?
Well,
I know it's a hard question. No, it's a reflective. Nobody more or less thinks about it. But
yeah, okay, actually, so this reminds me of something that MIS Quarterly came out with something about new theories of the future. Something they had five theories. A lot of really great work that was there, and one of the papers. Was about a theory about dignity, basically. It was called the care theory.
Yeah.
So the interview basically said, so how did you come up with that? So Dorothy Leidner is answering, and she says, well, you know, I really worked on it. I made a gigantic table, and then I did this, and then I did that. And I was thinking, wow, she really did that. That really worked for her. She got a really good result by doing, but she and her colleague, Olgerta, did really, really good work there. I would have never done that because that just wasn't the way that I tend to really work. And so the way that I tend to really work is to take an idea and then try to apply it to something. And then I look at it and I say, what's not right about that idea? And I keep on paring away at it, trying to be as clear as I possibly can with that idea. And a number of the things that I've written recently have been rejected because partially because maybe the ideas weren't perfect, but also partially because some of the reviewers didn't like the method. They thought the method was too informal. So I think actually method is one of the things that's a really big problem in our field where someone states this is a method and then you don't happen to do things exactly that way. And then they say, well, we can't accept it because you didn't do it exactly the way that someone else said you should do it. That is not necessarily the way that someone else should do creative work. Creative work by definition is creative. You don't exactly do things according to a cookie cutter approach. I'm a musician, and lately I've been looking a lot at music by Bach and some of the others. And one of the things that's really striking about their music is that they do not do cookie cutter. Stuff that's genius is not cookie cutter. Stuff that's genius is you look at it and you say, that's looking at something that's going in a new way. It's not resolving in exactly the trivial way that someone else might do it. It's going somewhere else. And, you know, we can't really do that kind of thing in a in something that's trying to be a scientific field, because that's an artistic field. That's different. But in many ways, this field hangs too tightly on methodology. And what I think is that there are some cases where methodology is tremendously important. Like if someone wants to decide whether a vaccine is good or not, then they better develop the
method,
and develop their sample properly, do the clinical trials, do the statistics. All of that really matters. For the kinds of stuff that we look at in this field, I think we need a little more poetic license in many ways.
Yeah. Well, that this is a very nice nice ending, and we need to mix a little bit art in methodology and methods, and give a little bit freedom in people, let's say, exploring this continuously changing things. And now we're talking, let's say, almost an hour, and my thinking is what we do from now on. You are an emeritus professor. You have put your legacy in the field. What do you think how the field could flourish in the future? I don't say that the field is not, I don't have, to be clear, I don't have any pessimistic view on the field. I think that the field grows, it moves, it has challenges, it overcomes challenges, sometimes in good way, sometimes in bad way. But that is, I would say, c'est la vie, that is how the things move. But if you reflect now and taking in account, you see the let's say, how the things are developing, what you think is the future of ice field, what we can expect in general about the future of ice field, and let's say in also in the philosophy aspects, should ice field make contribution to the philosophy, should our abstractions try to be, let's say, more general in different ways, should we, let's say, when we are talking about understanding and languages, should our knowledge from the field move in that direction and help those domains, let's say, get inspired for their research? What is your opinion?
Well, it's kind of hard to say what the future of almost any field should be that has social components to it. What I think is that the IS field probably needs to do something about finding ways to consolidate what it's producing. So it's not just people producing more and more and more and more papers that are kind of essentially unrelated to other papers, except in references that are basically perfunctory references for the most part. I think that if the field is really is Lynn Marcus wrote a paper 15 or 20 years ago about what would happen if the IS field disappeared. Right now, I'm not sure if the academic IS field disappeared, if it would make much difference in the world other than to the people who are in the IS field. I mean, other than the fact that they do teaching and convey some knowledge to people who use that knowledge, because it's very important knowledge in today's society. Today, you just can't avoid the stuff that we are talking about.
Yeah.
But the way that we're talking about it may not be very useful to a very large number of people in the world, which may not do a great job on justifying why we're here. Lately, there's been a great deal of attention to topics like big data and machine learning and possibly robotics and other things like that. So there's sort of a general feeling out there that, oh yeah, there's something going on there that is valuable and important in the world. But for our field by itself to really contribute, it needs to hook more into the world. It needs to offer, it needs to consolidate its knowledge in not just one way, in multiple different ways, it needs to consolidate knowledge. And that doesn't mean doing literature reviews that say that author A said X and author B said Y and author C said Z. Instead, it means going through it and making sense out of it so that it's coherent and actually fits together as something that's large and valuable. So that's what I've been trying to do largely myself with some occasional help from people who I've managed to meet at one time or another. I found that occasional help extremely valuable because other people bring in other ideas that I just would have never thought of. But anyway, moving forward, I think that the fact that we have lots of journals is at this point is good because we didn't have lots of journals when I started in this field. The fact that we have very important topics to talk about is really great, but we have to talk about them in ways that matter and ways that we can then do further abstractions that will help other people in the world. So our long-term existence depends on long-term value. So one more comment about that then is, if that's true, then why do we do publications the way that we do? So I just turned in some papers. One of them was 8 pages long. One of them was 15 pages long. One was 20 pages long. And those were the limits. These were for conferences. And by producing those artificial limits, we create a situation where you just can't really explain what you mean in many cases. Yeah. And we have computers. So why not make the papers be 5 pages long that explain what you really mean, and then provide any number of pages for online footnotes and so on that explain nuances and references and so on and so forth, and use the technology that we have to support the research publications that we have to make them more valuable instead of these very artificial restrictions. Yeah. About it has to be this long. And of course, you don't want to have articles that are 100 pages long and so on. That's why you should have articles that are 5 pages long. Yeah. And let people who are interested look further, but you have to figure out what you want to say in those 5 pages. Anyway, that's basically what I would say.
And that gives a good, nice ending, I would say, is that it's important because very often, you know, I see this built on the shoulders of giants logic. And that means very often that you need to be, let's say, aware about the literature in the field and then position your work and, let's say, go find the literature, say this is from this perspective, etc. And that is very valuable. But actually, somehow in that process of positioning or your work, etc., your main message gets lost. And I think that like making the main message available and then giving footnotes where you say, okay, based on the work, I was inspired on this, etc. And this is how it might actually make sure that the messages which you want to transfer will be more easily available and readable by people. I know some people in magnetic resonance, they say, we just start stopping to read all this around, but you just try to find in some place in the beginning where you say, this is what we discovered and this is what we say should be, let's say, used or implemented. And then if you want, you can drill down and look for the data and look for the method and all these things. But I think now we have a very, let's say, clear understanding of your suggestions. And I would not say only understanding, but also of your advice, clear understanding of your advice is how we could actually make our work more valuable for the community. And based on that long-term value, we can actually, better find our position in the academic work. And I would just like to say, if you have something that you think that we missed and we didn't had chance to say it now, if you can, you can actually say it, and then we can actually move forward with closing this, I would say, dynamically interesting podcast.
Well, I guess one thing we didn't really talk about very much was philosophy here.
I think so, but I didn't talk about it, because I said from our discussion, I found out that actually you walk the talk, and I wanted to see the walk. And the walk is that, I would just maybe say it, your position is that, I would say, pragmatism. And based on that, if somebody wants to follow this philosophical stream, they should definitely hear our podcast. And let's say, try to, in a way, maybe mimic or translate your steps in what fits them, in order to be clear example how philosophical, let's say, assumption really makes contribution in IS research. And that is why I just didn't mention too much philosophy. But what I found out is that I get a clear perspective how your philosophy, opinion, assumptions actually made strong contributions. Do I make mistake in this? Or...
Well, I think that you you captured most of what I was thinking. I mean, as I was thinking about this before our talk, I was trying to think, like, did philosophy in any way really have a major impact on the work that I did? And occasionally I bumped into the idea of pragmatism, but I never really thought about it tremendously. So before our conversation, the place that I came out concerning philosophy was actually really like the simplest possible idea about philosophy, which is be clear about what you're talking about. Try to define your terms well enough that someone else can understand them and can interpret them and then can bring their own meaning to them. Try to define what is the domain that you're really talking about. Don't get obsessive about whether something is or isn't a proper theory. Focus on whether statements are reasonably well justified and whether they can be used. Yeah. And so that's basically, I guess, the place that I come out with regard to philosophy, which isn't a particularly philosophical conclusion. I did write a paper about what I called epistemology light, that was in the ACM database, came out a year or two ago. Yeah, sure. What it basically said was that think about science as a bunch of knowledge objects. Yeah. And where a knowledge object is, it could be a concept, it could be a database, it could be data, it could be an example, it could be a theory, it could be a model. Those are all knowledge objects. And science is the accumulation, the evaluation, and the discarding and improvement of knowledge objects. And I think that's actually the way that I think about, if I had to have something that fits sort of into a philosophical framework, that's the way that I think I would normally go.
And let me share when I write a paper, because I read philosophy, I'm part of Ziegfeld, I run this podcast now, but also in the past by reading about meta studies, etc. And my goal was like, you need to demonstrate your philosophical background. So you start trying to come up with sexy terms and more vague terms, and you introduce a new term or jump it. Just to clarify that you have philosophical, let's say, knowledge in a way. But when we discuss here and now, what you said at the end is that being, let's say, philosophically inspired doesn't mean that you should not be understandable. The goal should be you to make to contribute with the value, to create value that could be useful to the community. That community could be practitioners or the academics. But this gives me, to me, a new perspective that you, as I try to label you in a way, be pragmatic in a way. The goal is to abstract, to create concepts, to create knowledge objects, but be clear about them. And this could be, in a way, the philosophical view of yours, which mm-hmm. is you be pragmatic yeah. in what you do, in a way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good summary. Thank you. Yeah.
So with this, we discussed a lot of things. And the good thing is that the ones who hear by the end understand how all this discussion is actually at the core of our Sickfill podcast idea. And for that, Professor Alter, I'm very thankful. And I hope we will see each other again somewhere in the conferences, or at least we can actually communicate our ideas in the future. With this, I'd like to thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the opportunity to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Okay. Bye.